The following program features an interview with Jeff Fogel, a candidate for Charlottesville Commonwealth Attorney. On June 1, 2017, Mr. Fogel was charged with assault following events that occurred during a public protest against white nationalists on Charlottesville's downtown mall. He was later released. This interview was conducted before the events of June 1st.
Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And it is not Rick Moore. This is Sean McCord, your reliable monthly host of a weekly show. And I'm sitting across from Jeff Fogel. Jeff is an attorney in town and also a candidate for Charlottesville Commonwealth Attorney. We know a little bit about that office because we had a conversation a few weeks ago. But today, our guest is Jeff Fogel. Jeff, welcome to WPVC.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it is such a pleasure. I enjoy getting to meet people who do things that I don't.
That leaves a lot of the world.
It absolutely does. I do a lot of things, but not everything. and I hope our audience feels the same way. So, Jeff, you've been here in town for about 10 years.
Correct.
And you have a practice now. Let's do a little background first. Let's talk about who you are, who Jeff Fogel, where you came from, why you're here, and what it is you're doing now.
Well, Sean, you know I'm not a youngster, so it's a fairly long story.
Oh, no, we've got time.
I grew up in New York. I went to college in New Jersey, Drew University. I got involved in thinking about lots of things that were happening in the mid-60s. There was the war in Vietnam.
Sure,
there
heard
was
of it.
The burgeoning civil rights movement in the mid-60s. I remember going on my first picket line against the barbershop that would not cut the hair of a young African-American boy, male, young. I remember going on my first anti-war march while I was in college and studying a lot of those issues. It was that era of a bursting sort of radicalism,
sure,
among young people,
what, sure,
you'd call really the new left at that time. And it was at that point that I decided I would go to law school because I thought that law school also was a way, that law itself was a way to effectuate social change. After all, I grew up watching the Supreme Court decide that segregation was illegal in Brown versus Board of Education.
That's right.
And it looked to me like that was the only way it could have happened, certainly from my young perspective. And so those were the kinds of issues that propelled me into being a lawyer and wanting to use those skills to further those causes. And of course, as I got a little older, I mean, you know, 1954, they decided Brown versus Board of Education, and they were to have integrated with, as the Supreme Court said, all deliberate speed. And 20 years later, we had the same problem.
Yeah.
And now, 60 years later, we have even more segregation than we had in education, anyway, than we had when 1954. So I was watching that, and that's what propelled me to law school. And when I was in law school, we had the Earl Warren Court was starting to develop the first rights of criminal defendants, even the right to a lawyer if you could be sent to prison. It seems amazing to people now that it wasn't that long ago that you didn't have a right to a lawyer. So the right to a lawyer, the right to not be coerced into a confession, all of those kinds of things that we're now very used to, the Miranda warnings that everybody knows because they watch TV, all came about in that era when I was in law school. So it was very exciting to see that process going on and all of that progress being made in terms of civil rights and civil liberties. But I was also fortunate while I was there to start working for the ACLU locally in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, as I said, the time of the Vietnam War, so we got involved in a lot of issues involving the draft and teaching people draft counseling. I also worked there the summer of 1967 after the riots in Newark and was involved in some really fascinating, unsuccessful litigation with some very high-powered lawyers from around the country over issues of police abuse that were happening in the Newark community. So I continued doing that, and when I left, I was able to get a scholarship from what was then the Office of Economic Opportunity, which was part of Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, his so-called war on poverty, working at legal services. So I worked with community groups, tenant groups, and I started when I went to municipal court, which is comparable to our general district court here in Virginia,
yeah,
to see that there were all these people who didn't have a lawyer, and there was no public defender there, and some of these people were being sent to jail 30, 60, 90 days, whatever it was. So I sat down with the chief judge at the time, and I started a little project defending indigent people in Newark Municipal Court who were facing possible jail time. And I was able to get a couple of other lawyers involved as well. Nowadays, you can't do that under legal services because of restrictions, but that's what I was doing. They can only do civil work and only certain kinds of civil work at legal services.
Oh, really?
Congress has restricted very severely what they're allowed to do. That's why I've always been impressed with, say, the Legal Aid Justice Center here,
sure,
which has been able to raise its money independent of the Legal Services Corporation, which gives them the freedom to do the kinds of things that the Legal Services Corporation forbids. And we could go through those, but that's another whole show, I'm sure. But I was involved very much because I was on the board of Legal Services, so I was intimately involved in learning about, you know, all those restrictions and all those laws and so on. So after a couple of years there, some friends of mine had been in Chicago handling the Chicago 7 case, if you remember, that occurred after the uproar of the 68 Democratic Convention.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They came back to Newark, and we started what we called a law commune at the time. We were I still am very egalitarian, at least in ideal, that the society be much more communal. And we tried to do that, where everybody had an equal voice, everybody got the same pay, $100 a week, mm-hmm. but it was the same.
Mm-hmm.
We had a communal kitchen, we bought food together, we ate together, we lived separately, but everything else was like that. It was very difficult, as we learned from the it was not so difficult to think about, it was much more difficult to put into effect. So I was there for 3 or 4 years, I left. I went and joined the faculty at Rutgers Law School, being a clinical teacher in what they called the Urban Legal Clinic, where you both handle cases on behalf of the urban poor, and we're teaching students how to try cases in court.
And so were your students joining you in some of those cases?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, students, and some of the students in their third year could actually do the cases as long as we were sitting next to them.
Interesting.
And preparing them. So we would prepare them, teach them how to try a case, and we did regular training on examination, cross-examination, openings, closings, all of the little attributes of a trial. And it's wonderful to see some of them really shine, you know, people in law school. I did that for 3 years, and then I left, and I went to Puerto Rico for a couple of years to work with a project that was started by the National Lawyers Guild to do civil rights work in Puerto Rico. Now, again, that's another whole show, I'm sure, about my experiences in Puerto Rico, but, you know, there are two systems in Puerto Rico. There is the system of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, which is based on the Spanish Civil Code. And then there's the overlay of the federal system, which also includes the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So in the state courts, principally, they follow the Spanish Civil Code tradition, which is quite different than what we follow, which is the common law tradition. But partly for that reason, many of the lawyers in Puerto Rico did not feel comfortable going to federal court because their experience was different in terms of the law. Also, there were language barriers. In the state courts, it's all in Spanish, and in federal court, everything's in English. So there was some reluctance on those grounds. There's also some reluctance for, say, cultural reasons. There were a lot of people that I worked with who were supporting independence, didn't like the presence of the United States, didn't like the idea of having to appear before a United States judge in order to assert their rights.
Mm.
So these were the issues that were going on when I was in Puerto Rico.
Well, so I don't want to spin off into another whole show, but I just want to spend another minute there in Puerto Rico. What brought you there?
Well, several things. One, I had had a long-standing desire to learn Spanish.
Okay.
And this was an opportunity to immerse myself in Spanish. I decided to, you know, that teaching I like, but it's not sufficient for me. It doesn't allow me to the full panoply of what I can do.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to leave the school anyway, and this opportunity opened, and I was active in the National Lawyers Guild. And I thought, wow, this is a great opportunity. I'm even going to get paid.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot. I think I was $14,000 or $15,000. But there was an established community that I could relate to there. And I could use the skills that I had developed to help train people in some of the federal court procedures and litigation. So I worked on a number of cases, including 2 or 3 criminal cases with people in federal court. There's long stories to, you know, I obviously got very interested in Puerto Rico.
And
I became a big fan of music and
sure. The
food and the people.
So I was going to say, not a bad thing to be able to spend some time on a Caribbean island. My guest is Jeff Fogel. This is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on WPVC. And we need to mention up front that you are you are a candidate for office for the Charlottesville Commonwealth Attorney. So I want to get to that.
Okay.
But when I invite my guests on, I like to just get to know them a little bit more, mm-hmm. And find out, you know, what brought them to where they are today. So we've left you on the sunny beaches of Puerto Rico.
Okay, I came back, and there was an opening to be the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey, mm-hmm. where I had worked as a law student. And I applied, and I got it. And that was a very exciting time for me. From 1982 to 1988, I was the executive director, and also acting as the legal director. And there were a lot of very hot issues at the time in the state. The death penalty was a hot issue at that time, but a whole variety of issues. If anybody looks at the ACLU, they see how many different kinds of issues that they deal with, aside from free speech, which is the most obvious.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then I decided to take a couple of years off. So I went to with my girlfriend to Mexico and spent 2 years there.
How was your Spanish by then?
It was getting good. It was getting good. I had been to Mexico to study before I went to Puerto Rico, and then Puerto Rico, and then back again to Mexico, and it was getting good. And I enjoyed it. It was interesting. I was getting quite a little bored and antsy by the time the 2 years were up, anxious to get back. So I went back to New York. It was hard getting a job, but a friend of mine was running a legal plan for a health and hospital workers union in New York City and hired me as the litigation director. So I did that for a while, but he got into a fight with the union president. And since I was his deputy, I lost my job, too. Mm. So then I went back into private practice. I went back to New Jersey. And was doing mostly all civil rights stuff. I was representing the people fighting the state takeover of the Newark school system, which is something that happened later on under the Voting Rights Act. I was doing civil rights litigation, and I was doing criminal defense work. And things started to get better and better. You just can't go into practice and all of a sudden make a lot of money. You got to build up, like anybody in a retail establishment. So I went on doing that until I think it was about 2003. And I was very upset about George Bush and what was happening in the country at that time with the detainees in Guantanamo, just a whole, you know, the Patriot Act. It's hard to remember all of it these days, but all of that stuff was going on. And there was an opening at a place where I had worked a little bit as a law student called the Center for Constitutional Rights. Mm-hmm. So I applied there. They were looking for a new legal director, and I became the legal director there. And we shortly after that, we won the case in the Supreme Court on behalf of the detainees, none of whom we knew, on Guantanamo, at least their right to file a habeas corpus petition to establish whether or not their detention at Guantanamo was lawful. That habeas corpus simply means, is it a lawful incarceration? Mm. So we didn't actually win their right to freedom. We won simply the right for them to ask the courts to consider whether they had a right to freedom. But that was a very big thing to win at the time. Very big. And there were a number of issues like that that we were working on. And I worked there for a few years. And then I worked for a brief time at the ACLU again. Again, litigating mostly all First Amendment cases. And then I had the opportunity to move down here. And as I told you, I was teaching at NYU. I was teaching a civil rights clinic there. And I was training students there in litigation. And then I was making a fair amount of money, but New York was becoming just impossible to live in. I had a three-story walk-up. It was costing me $2,200 a month, and, you know, I was making over $100,000, but still, at $2,200 a month, you're not doing
it
too well.
Yeah.
So I was coming to visit somebody here, and it's a very beautiful place to come to.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go out to dinner, and you know, a lot of great places to eat, the kinds of things that people from New York like, culture, food, and it's much prettier.
Yeah.
So I decided.
And less crowded.
Well, that's a big deal, less crowded.
Yes.
Although I do still complain about the traffic here, because it's even in the 10 years I've been here, it's really grown a lot, and the traffic has become quite different just in 10 years.
Okay, that's fair, but I still I still chuckle at people who complain about the traffic here.
Yes.
No.
I understand.
You got home. You have no idea what it's like.
So, yes, and everything's easier. Getting into a restaurant's easier. Getting mm-hmm. into a cultural event's easier. You don't have to plan 4 months ahead in order to go see a play.
Oh, my gosh. I love telling this story. When Bruce Springsteen was on tour a few years ago, he came here. So we have friends in New York, and we have friends who were friends of ours in New York, and you know they got married and they have kids, and they're sort of they're kind of leading the life that we might have led, my wife and I, if we had stayed there. So we kind of use that as a model. So they wanted to see Springsteen. So they did this complicated thing where the husband worked in New Jersey. They lived in Brooklyn. He had to, like, drive through Manhattan, pick up the kids, bring them home. The wife came. They did this complicated dance with vans and trains and babysitters, and it took them, you know, like weeks of planning and hours of execution to go out and see Bruce in concert.
At the Meadowlands?
Probably. And then when he came here a few weeks later, right. I was at work, said, the concert, you know, it's like 5 o'clock, concert at 7. Now, probably time for me to go home. Drove home, had some dinner. My wife and I got in the car. We came back. We parked in my work parking spot and walked over to the arena, saw him, and then walked back to my car. And, you know, we're back in home, time for coffee.
Right.
Same show.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. No, that's one of the nice things about being here.
So you reinvented, sounds like you've reinvented yourself a lot.
Yes, I have.
But you've been here now for 10 years.
Right.
You think maybe you're starting to grow some roots?
Oh, I don't have any plans to move from here, to tell you the truth. I'm now 72, and all my friends, well, not all my friends, but many of my friends have already retired.
Yeah.
But I got a lot of juice left in me, is
sure.
what it feels like, and I would be bored if I wasn't doing what I'm doing. So I'm excited to jump back in, for example, in this race. But since I've been here, I've really focused on civil rights litigation. I hooked up with Steve Rosenfield, who I know you know.
Steve's a good friend, and he's a friend of the show. He's been on this show.
And Steve's been focused a lot on, he did a lot of death penalty cases, mm-hmm. which are very, very, not just difficult, but also emotionally difficult for a lawyer. I don't care how bad your client is, you inevitably develop some human relationship with your clients, however bad that they've done.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you start to think about what rests on your shoulders in terms of their life, is quite an emotional drain. But I've seen Steve go through it and do it successfully. And then, of course, Steve has focused on the innocence of several people now in the last 10 years, started with Earl Washington case, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. was quite a deal. And then more recently, Robert Davis,
right.
who we got an unconditional pardon for eventually. And now he's working on the case of Jens Søring and uncovering some very substantial evidence that Søring, you know, didn't do it. I can't judge it. I'm not the, and I'm not the judge. Nobody's asking me it. Of course, Steve's my colleague, so I'm on his side. But you know, he's been doing great work, and I was very lucky to meet Steve. And Steve had room in his office, and we immediately hit it off after lunch, and shared all the same kinds of values and approach to practicing law. We both like to come to the office in jeans. We have that kind of relaxed atmosphere at the office. So that all of that was perfect for me, and we've been working together ever since. Doing prison litigation, the right of prisoners to read, the right of a blind woman to get an education because they didn't want to teach her in Braille, so they wouldn't give her a GED, and we finally forced them to do that. We forced them to change their whole process over allowing prisoners to read things, and I'm still involved in some litigation with them.
Let's talk about that. We've got a couple minutes before our first break, but you were telling me some of that before the show, and I think people will find this shocking how few rights prisoners have. I mean, when you say it that way, you think, well, they're in prison. They've,
right.
they've had their rights stripped away. But these are basic human things like being able to read or read poetry. Tell us more about that.
Well, let me give you the overall. The overall, from my perspective, and I'd have to fill it in with evidence, obviously, mm-hmm. is that there are many, many times that the Department of Corrections, and I don't limit that to Virginia, acts in an arbitrary and capricious way. And I sometimes think that they think that if they can get these bad people who are in prison to respond to arbitrary and capricious kinds of demands on them, that they will then follow the law when they get out of prison. I think it's preposterous.
Yeah.
But that's what happens. So, for example, the first case we got involved in, there's a magazine called Prison Legal News. And it comes out every month now. It was started by a prisoner in Washington State 10, 15 years ago. He'd been released. It's got 10,000 subscribers around the country. And it's really about prison legal news. Now, it's mostly to prisoners, but every lawyer that I know that does any prison work also gets it because we have no other way to be informed. As you can imagine, there's not a lot of educational programs about prisoners' rights for lawyers because there's not enough lawyers interested in doing those cases to make it worthwhile for anybody. So there are many, many problems that prisoners have in litigating, especially now. They passed a law in 1996 called the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which limited the rights of prisoners to litigate. And it limited the amount of fees that lawyers could get even when they did valid cases. So in one area, they had been censoring this magazine, and we sued. And some of their responses initially were, well, we're censoring the magazine because we find that some of the articles have anti-law enforcement content.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, man, you could pick up a newspaper any day and read, and or this guy's got a tattoo on in this picture in this magazine, and we think it might be a gang tattoo. Okay, you better not show any NBA basketball games then, okay, because
right.
all these guys have tattoos that are covering their body, and who knows what they are. They wouldn't allow, somebody sent a map that was having a conversation by Pen Pal with a prisoner about the situation in the Middle East and sent the prisoner a map of Iran. The prison rejected it because they have a rule, prisoners are not allowed to receive maps. Now, you could, it sounds, I mean, you could think of some ways they don't want prisoners to have maps of the area around the prison.
Sure.
And that makes sense. But a map of Iran, I mean, what are you going to do with a map of Iran? So we had to, like, you know, litigate that, and then they gave in. I had worked, oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. My guest lecturing me on maps is Jeff Fogel. This is Sean McCord. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. This is Sean McCord. My guest is Jeff Fogel, and we were talking about, we've been talking about many things, but we're in the middle of talking about rights of prisoners. Let's just kind of finish up that conversation, then we'll do a larger talk about what you're doing now in your practice here in Virginia.
So there was a book I had worked on. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the principal person, but I'd worked on it. How, for a prisoner, how to handle your own litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was rejected by the Department of Corrections because it would encourage prisoners to bring lawsuits. Of course, we sued, and they gave in, and it was allowed in. There was an instance where a pen pal wanted to send his friend in prison a box set of CDs of Dylan Thomas reading his poetry and Shakespeare.
Right.
And they wouldn't allow that in.
Okay, now...
Why not? Okay, their argument was, we need to censor things, and it's very difficult. We can go through a book very quickly. It's much more difficult for us to listen. We'd have to listen to the whole CD to make sure nobody had put something in that CD, such as, I guess, escape plans. even though this is a box CD with wrap around it that came directly from Barnes & Noble.
Uh-huh.
But somehow somebody was going to sneak into the three box, you know, the three CDs and put an escape plan into it. Well, the judge looked at him and said, I mean, they really wanted to fight this one out.
Yeah.
The judge looked at him and said, what are you, crazy? You don't want a prisoner to listen to poetry by Dylan Thomas? And I was also fortunate I had an expert witness who was a English professor at the university who was teaching a class on voice in poetry, the precise issue. And she was very excited about writing how important it is to voice in poetry, mm-hmm. particularly the unique voice that Dylan Thomas has. So we won that case. They denied.
So, but did the guards have to listen to the CDs first?
Because
I can think of worse things than guards
right.
having to, listen, you know, to listen to some poetry
to
of Dylan Thomas. Yeah.
It's up to them if they want to. And then I'm litigating now. There was a guy in prison who's an artist, and he was subscribing to the Drawing Magazine and the Artist Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are two professional artist magazines.
Sure.
But they have pictures of paintings that have nude women in them. And you're not allowed to have any images, nude images, in the prison. Now, of course, when you point out to the prison that the seal of the state of Virginia has an exposed breast with a nipple showing, they have no answer for that one. And somehow that's okay mm-hmm. to have the seal of the state of Virginia that has that.
Mm-hmm.
But a magazine which is a serious artist magazine, and nobody can learn art without doing figures. You must do them,
sure.
and you must do them starting as nude. So the prisoner wasn't asking that he have nude models that I could understand they would say no to. But this
Although,
was just a picture.
Behind glass, I don't see the horror, but sure.
Right, a picture of a painting.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're on the cusp of settling that one. But this is a constant thing. And we had the same problem in jails. We litigated against the jail in Virginia Beach.
Mm-hmm.
We're in litigation against the jail in Winchester, the Northwest Regional Adult Detention Center. So a lot of that. I represented a Muslim who wanted to grow a short beard. The prison claimed that you could hide things in a beard. The prison claimed that you could change identity quickly by having a beard. That case had to go up to the Fourth Circuit, and we won that case. And they decided it was easier for them to let everybody have a quarter-inch beard than just the Muslim. So we won that right. And it's amazing because, I will tell you, everybody in prison knows who I am. Just because of these, even these two issues about a beard, because they have no personal freedoms. And just the freedom to have a quarter-inch beard is a meaningful thing to people in prison. And it's not causing any problems whatsoever. But, again, that's one of those that I call an arbitrary and capricious rule. You might want to limit beards and not have 10-inch beards, and maybe you could hide something like a blade.
A CD.
A 10-inch,
CD of Dylan
CD
Thomas.
CD of Dylan Thomas. So, you know, those are the kinds of things. And one was a blind woman, and this was amazing, a blind woman, and you are required, if you don't have a high school diploma, to get your GED while you're in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So she was not getting it because they couldn't teach her because she was blind. So we were deducting good time credits from her because she didn't get her GED. But she couldn't get her GED because they wouldn't give it to her. They finally said, okay, we're going to waive the requirement that you get your GED and give you back your good time credits. But she wanted a GED.
Yeah.
So we fought them, and eventually they had to get somebody who could do it in Braille. But an amazing thing was they had somebody teaching Braille to sighted prisoners at the prison in Fluvanna, so that that's a skill that they might have mm-hmm. that they could use when they get out.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman who was teaching them offered to do this for nothing, and they wouldn't let her. I'm just giving you a picture of how arbitrary they can be and why it's necessary to have at least a few lawyers, and there are very few lawyers doing anything. Steve and I and a bunch of others, not mostly me, just litigated the conditions on death row. And after we brought suit, the prison officials basically acknowledged that they were terrible conditions, even for people who were planning to be killed. And they spent a little bit of money and did the things that they were supposed to do. And hopefully that's going to carry over into solitary issues, which they are working on, solitary confinement. So there's a wide span of issues involving prisoners and their rights and limitations on what prisoners can do. Because we had a case we just lost of a woman who was raped at Fluvanna by a civilian employee. The Department of Corrections investigated, concluded she was telling the truth, fired the guy, and then refused to give her any money because she filed her grievance 15 days late.
Yeah.
You have to file it within 30 days, and she did it 15 days late. And that was upheld by a judge. Now, we have that case pending before the Supreme Court right now of Virginia, and we'll see whether we can get that overturned. But those are some of the kinds of things that happen in the prison system, and there are too few lawyers around willing to do any of it. So when the couple of lawyers like Steve and I and two others, you know, so do it, I get 12 letters a week asking
sure.
for help.
Sure.
And I can't possibly do it. But I try to write back to everybody. So in any event, I've done prison litigation most of my career, but I've done a little more since I've been here.
So we are fortunate, you and I, to live in the People's Republic of Charlottesville, the heart of the resistance. You're grinning too. And you're running for public office. So being progressive, being for civil rights is not a bad thing in this town. But as someone who's running for public office, how do you address accusations that you are soft on crime, that you are coddling prisoners, and that you would carry this into Commonwealth's Attorney Office, and what about the victims, and don't prisoners deserve all the treatment that they get?
Well, let's start with the victims, because I think that's important.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that bothers me about the criminal justice system is that it really uses victims, and it doesn't provide so much help as they should for victims. Victims have certain rights now within the criminal justice system. The right to be heard, the right to get assistance from victims' assistance programs, which we have here in mm-hmm. Charlottesville as well, and to receive some possible restitution through the Crime Victims Restitution Board. But that usually happens only when it's in the criminal justice system. If the person is never caught, that victim may not get any of the kinds of benefits that you'll get or he will get if the victim is caught. But so it shouldn't be so connected to whether you catch the perpetrator.
So they're not officially a victim until somebody goes to trial.
In some respects, exactly.
Yeah.
But they are victims, and we should focus on the needs of those victims, and we should focus on them independent of whatever happens in the criminal justice system. Because, as you know, probably, when somebody is acquitted, it doesn't technically mean that they're innocent.
Right.
It means that the state hasn't proven their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's right.
That doesn't mean that there's not a victim. There still is a victim. The state just hasn't proven it. And so we have to recognize that those are victims too. And we also have to recognize that the traumatic experience that victims have, and it is traumatic for people, even with a robbery, to say nothing of things like rapes or a wounding, things like
or
that.
Assault.
They don't end in a year or so. You know, they can come back and haunt people. So we need to focus on victims, at, qua victims, independent of the criminal justice system as a society. And certainly when they're involved in the criminal justice system, they do need. But again, and I think this is something that my adversary has said as well, the Commonwealth Attorney doesn't technically represent victims. They represent the society.
Mm-hmm.
And the victim is a part of that society, of course, but the Commonwealth Attorney and the criminal justice system should be looking at what's best and for the society as it recognizes the harm that's been done to the victim and the need to compensate that victim, whether it's in emotional ways or financial ways to do that. So the language that you just quoted is really language from the 60s, which got us into the situation we're in now about you just need to be the opposite. You need to be tough on crime. You need to have no regard for prisoners and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on one level, it's totally irrational. Most people who go to prison get out of prison. So if you just want to send people to prison and not care what happens to them or torture them there, what do you expect they're going to be like when they come back out? And that's what we've got to be concerned about, too. 90% of the people are going to come back out of prison. And if they come out angry, and if they come out without skills, and they still come out illiterate, and they come out without a chance of a job or housing, what's left for them to do? What they know, which
right.
is crime.
Right.
So we can be safer if we're smarter. So we have to look at putting people in prison, certainly as punishment in a variety of cases, but we don't need to send them there for 60 years. We don't need many of them for 40 years, 10, 15 years. Prison is a brutal place. I think people don't realize how, you know, you hear people talk about, oh, they have it soft, they have a TV, they get three meals a day, they got, try it. I want to encourage everybody to spend a year in prison. Now, I have never, but I have been to so many prisons in Puerto Rico, where I worked, in New Jersey, where I worked, in New York, where I worked, here. I even visited prisons in Cuba when I was there. I was given permission to go visit prisons there because of my work here. And it's a terrible place. I don't care where you are. Being locked up is the punishment. You know, one wise judge a long time ago said, we send people to prison as punishment. We don't send them there for punishment. So the punishment is being deprived of your liberty.
Right.
We also have to recommend there's another set of victims here. The family of the person we're sending to prison is often a victim as well, and they haven't done anything. So if the person we're sending to prison was the bread earner, well, then what's happening to the family that's left behind?
Mm-hmm.
They're going on welfare. That's costing us money. And it's also causing all kinds of disruption in that family life. If they have children, and in this state, you have no public transportation to prisons. It is very difficult for families to visit prisoners.
Really?
Unless they have a car. And again, since most prisoners are poor, there's often prisoners and their families don't have cars. So you're breaking up a family relationship that may be very important to the children there. And we know, for example, that children who've had parents in prison are more likely to go to prison themselves. So we've really got to take all of those factors into consideration in terms of what's the best thing for society, what's the best thing for public safety, and what's the humane thing to do, and what's the fair thing to do. So we initiated back in the starting in the 80s and 90s, mandatory minimums, which took away the discretion from judges even to look at each person as a single human being, that everybody was the same and everybody got sentenced to these draconian sentences, regardless rather, of any other factors that should be taken into consideration. And so we ended up, as people now know, with more prisoners than anybody else in the world.
Yeah.
You know, the statistics are we're 25, you know, we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. And many states are actually being proactive in reducing their prison populations. But, you know, Virginia's is growing. At the very time when other states, New Jersey, reduced their prison population under Chris Christie, in the last, since the 2000, by 28%. Virginia's has risen by 4%.
Now, is Virginia prison population rising because we're taking prisoners from other states, or is it solely because of what's happening in Virginia courts?
It's only because of what's happening in Virginia courts.
Really?
Yeah, and the mandatory sentencing in Virginia, which, you know, followed the federal system as well. And much but not all of it, of course, is attributable to the war on drugs, but not the most. Because there are many, many other ways. I mean, for example, if you commit a larceny, now we have a larceny threshold level of $200. If you commit a robbery, nobody's harmed, nobody's threatened. I steal something from your car. If it's more than $200, it's a felony. Well, once you get a felony, your life is almost over.
And this has been discussed lately. This has been in the news about raising that cap. So I have two questions about that. And one of them, this is, again, me playing devil's advocate. I say, you know, someone breaks into my car and steals my iPod.
Right.
Well, I've got to deal with the insurance company. I've got to deal with all the glass in my car. I may never work the same again. And now my iPod is, why shouldn't that person go to prison? Why shouldn't they pay for what they did? That's question sort of.
Well, there's a lot of ways to look at it. I mean, if you looked at it in the most crass, mundane way, $30,000 to send them to prison. $5,000 to solve your problem. Now, why are we spending the other $25,000? Let's take $5,000 of that and give it to you as the victim. Put this person in a community service for 100 hours or 200 hours or whatever, thereby contributing punishment because they're being forced, basically like slavery. We're forcing them to work to pay off some of the money that we're going to give to you as the victim to solve your problem. And it seems to me that's a much more rational response to that. The question always is this person that we're not putting in prison a danger to us? And that's what we should be focused on primarily. I believe in punishment, but punishment doesn't necessarily mean prison, and it could mean prison. But it doesn't mean 70 years of prison. It could mean 5 years of prison. And as I said, community service is a form of punishment. When you force somebody to work, that's like slavery. And you know the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which outlawed slavery, except for people convicted of a crime.
Right.
So you are entitled to put them into slavery. And it's much more beneficial to the community. That person could stay home, whether it's with an ankle bracelet. You know, if you want to track their activities, they are able to stay home with their family. They can make money. They can contribute to their family. They can make money that will pay back the state for taking care of the victim, as the state should be able to do. And we're not spending the $30,000 on it. We're spending five. So that's what makes more sense in that kind of example.
And are there states that are doing that?
You can raise the felony threshold level high, but
and compensating the victims
right.
of crimes.
And I don't see a lot of states doing the other, but we abolished parole in Virginia, and that's one of the problems we have.
I remember that under Governor Allen.
Right, and that was in 1994.
Yeah.
Now, there's still people subject to parole, but for the most part, there's no parole. And I think there are states like New Jersey recognizing that that's not the right way to go. And as soon as we start spending money on hospice care in the prisons, it's going to cost a fortune because the $30,000 I talked about was just your basic prisoner without mental health problems, without serious medical problems, and not being old and needing all that kind of care. So you can go up to $100,000 with people. We've got people with Hep C in prison, and the prison costs them $84,000 to treat them. And they don't want to treat them. Not that they don't want to treat them. They can't afford to treat them. And they can do it cheaper outside. So there are many, many reasons why it just doesn't make sense to have that many people locked up. And when you look particularly at the discrepancy racially in terms of who's going to prison, in Virginia, 60% of the people in prison are African American. They constitute 20% of our population. And it's the same thing here in Charlottesville. I mean, I think a lot of people don't believe that Charlottesville is contributing to what we call mass incarceration, but it is. Even though they're not, and it bothers me that they're not keeping statistics in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. I tried to find out how many people are in prison from Charlottesville now.
Yeah.
Nobody has a record of that. I tried to find out how many people were sentenced to prison from the Charlottesville Circuit Court, which is where felony offenses are considered. Nobody has a record of that.
Is that one of those things where people aren't keeping records because they don't want people knowing the answer to the question, or is it just sloppy management?
I don't think any would admit the former.
I was asking you.
I'm not sure, because the answer I've gotten, and it is an answer in part, is that everybody uses a system designed by the Supreme Court for record keeping.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you have to do that. But my complaint is you could also keep records that were tracking. If you really cared about mass incarceration, if you really cared about racial inequity, you would be tracking those two things and Charlottesville's relationship to that problem and comparing it to other places. So, yes, I think some of it is because they're stuck with a database that was given to them by the Supreme Court.
Right.
But no, I don't believe that they couldn't have established their own. It's not that difficult to establish how many people went to prison or how many are in prison. And that's the only way we could actually track it. But I look then at the arrest statistics. Charlottesville arrested 2,500 people in 2016. I then compared that, because the FBI does this, in their year-end report, how many people in a town of 50,000, what is the average number of arrests in a town our size, 50,000? And it comes out to 1,750. So we arrest 2,500 and the normal is 1,750. Why are we arresting so many more people than other towns of our same size? And I've given these stats to the chief, who I like and I talk to. I'm hoping he's going to come up with some answers for me as to why it's happening. I think he's interested too.
My guest asking questions and recommending that we all spend at least a year in jail is Jeff Fogel. This is the Wake Up Call. We'll be right back. This is Sean McCord hosting the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. My guest this week is Jeff Fogel, who is a candidate for Charlottesville Commonwealth Attorney. So, Jeff, you've been talking about justice and inequities, and some of these numbers, even though I've heard them before, are still shocking to me. So, you have spent your life fighting the good fight on these issues,
right?
Fighting for civil rights, fighting for fairness in the justice system. How does that translate to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office? How would you, as a candidate for that office, bring that with you? And what could you do if you were elected as Commonwealth Attorney?
Well, the Commonwealth Attorney has an extraordinary amount of power in the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
After all, that's the person who has the power to decide who gets charged and what they get charged with. And they have extended power to affect police conduct. They have the power to affect the conduct of probation, and they have the power to affect sentencing in the courts by what kinds of charges they bring. So recognizing that you have that substantial authority within the criminal justice system and to respond to the needs of your community, because after all, you're only elected from your community, and therefore, presumably, you bring the conscience of your community to that position. And so, for example, I've promised that I would not prosecute small marijuana possession cases. Well, I've believed that marijuana should be legal for 50 years.
Okay.
This is not something I just came up with for this election campaign. But there's a growing recognition in the country that this is not something that belongs in the criminal justice system. For a wide swath of the country, it's now legal for at least medicinal purposes, and for an increasing number of states, it's legal for recreational purposes. And finally, we've had some major breakthroughs here in Virginia, with the head of the Senate calling for decriminalization, a Republican, and it going before a study commission. We've got lots of conservatives who are supporting the decriminalization of marijuana and see that the criminal justice system resources are being wasted on that when we do have more serious crime that we could focus on. So you could shift resources away from some of the war on drugs, which has been a disastrous failure, and put it into two ways. Number one, shift those resources into more serious crime, violent crime, and people who prey on the community, and shift some of those resources into the social service providers that we need to amplify to help deal with drug addiction. Mental health is a major issue in the prisons. So many people in prison have serious mental health issues. So many people in our local jail have serious mental health issues. And if we don't deal with the mental health issue, we're not dealing with the problem that they present to us as a potential danger. So we need to amplify those resources, mental health, drug addiction, family counseling, assistance for families, and so on, in order to cut down on crime. I was very impressed, even when the police chief got up before the city council and said, if you want to reduce crime, you have to deal with the socioeconomic conditions that cause crime.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to, and he is absolutely right on that. And I want to lend my voice from the perspective of being a Commonwealth attorney as an advocate for that very question. Because too often people in the criminal justice system only focus on their role in crime. And from what I can tell in my study, the police don't stop crime. They catch people who've committed crime when things are going well. The prosecutor can't stop crime. What we need is a very smart prosecutor and a police department that uses its resources to focus on the most serious crime and to shift, as I said, some resources. Look, drugs should be in a public health issue. Mental health is a public health issue. It's not a criminal justice system issue. The people in the criminal justice system have no expertise on these things. We have people who have expertise, and those are the people who should be doing it, and we should be building those people up in terms of what a major role they can play in assisting us in dealing with issues like crime. And then again, we have to address socioeconomic questions because, as I said, you just go through prison, nurse, and you just know not so literate, poor family, trauma when they were young. You could go down the list of all of the things that, that represent the broad swath of people in prison. Obviously, not everybody who suffers from those problems ends up being a criminal. But we do know some of the generalized socioeconomic things that contribute to crime, and we're not addressing them well, in my view. But again, as the Commonwealth Attorney, I would not impose mandatory minimum sentences. You have a choice. For example, if I committed a larceny within 1,000 feet of a school, that becomes a mandatory minimum because it's within 1,000 feet of a school. Well, the prosecutor doesn't have to charge the 1,000 feet of the school, just the larceny. That's what makes sense. So there's almost every area that I can conceive of where there's a mandatory minimum sentence, there's another charge that you can bring that gives judges discretion as to how much, you know, as to what the sentence should be. And judges should have that discretion because we should be looking at everybody as an individual because they are individuals. Each of them is still a human being. I even think prisoners should be able to vote in prison. I don't understand why we don't let them. We haven't excluded them completely from society. We haven't expelled them to an island, you know, in the Caribbean like they used to. So they should be able to vote.
And they are still citizens.
Exactly. And they're going to be citizens. And hopefully you want them to be productive citizens. And if you take away things like the right to vote simply, you're sort of drawing away from, you're pulling people away from the civic society.
You know, that's interesting. I want to get back to the war on crime in a second, but this discussion about prison or felon voting rights, when I hear it talked about lately, is predicated on there doesn't even seem to be a question that they should have their votes, they should have their rights taken away from them. The question has always become, under what circumstances do they have them restored? But I agree. I have not heard anybody else, let alone a candidate for public office, say, why are we even taking that away in the first place?
Yeah.
I mean, what do we accomplish? Now, you're running for the Democratic nomination.
Right.
There's a perception out there that felons just naturally vote Democrat. I don't know where that comes from. I think that's, personally, this is me opining here, I think that's largely driven by the other side. It feels like those people aren't like me, so they must be Democrats.
And therefore, we shouldn't let them vote. I mean, that's a ridiculous argument.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the argument that's used against allowing D.C. to become a state,
right?
Because, oh, they're all black, and therefore they're all going to vote Democrat. Well, let's take away Montana's right to vote, all right? Because they're all Republican. You can't do that. We have that issue with Puerto Rico.
Mm. We've had that issue with California.
Right.
After the last election, I heard people saying, well, if it weren't for California, then Trump would have won the popular vote.
Right.
Well, but, I mean, like...
It's like, a big part of the country.
Right. Like 12% of the people live in California. So.
Yeah, so that's just how I feel. I think the more humanely and the more we involve prisoners as real citizens and give them trades and things like that, we're going to be safer. And I think people have to realize that. And we're going to need to cut down on the prison population to be able to get the resources. Mm-hmm. After all, you know, the prisons are the most expensive agency in the state. More than $1.2 billion is being spent.
Yikes.
And it's just not the kind of thing that's worth spending that kind of money on when we can be much more focused on who needs to be in prison and work on the other people, particularly the nonviolent offenders, to reintegrate them. But we also need jobs and things like that and housing. But I think that the Commonwealth Attorney has an obligation to be tracking this issue of mass incarceration, tracking the racial inequities. Why is it that do black people commit more crime than white people? If so, which crimes? And is there a reason for that? It's certainly not genetic. Nobody's going to claim that there's a genetic propensity on the part of a class of the population. Well, maybe
not
some
nobody.
Do.
Right, okay. Not nobody.
They have a hard argument to make with the scientists, I think, that there's a genetic propensity to commit
Charles
crime.
Murray leaps to mind, but that's another discussion.
Okay. But so since most people agree with that, then you have to agree that there are socioeconomic conditions that are leading to this. And we need to look at that because the future of the country really depends on it, I think. You know, the country is still split into minorities and whites in so many ways. Education is segregated. Our town is segregated.
Oh, yeah.
Back when I first moved here, I didn't see any black people. I really didn't. Mm-hmm. It was only after I moved here and I started to look around that I saw, oh, West Haven.
Right.
Well, it's buried in this little corner in a hollow that nobody can see. There's some people in public housing over on Riverside Avenue, but nobody knows where Riverside Avenue is. And there's some people, you know, and it just struck me that there really were two societies here.
And
one
you see
very
it,
rich one.
You see it here. I mean, you came here from New Jersey. I came here from New York. It's kind of shocking to look around and A, notice all the white people, and then B, slowly notice on the periphery, oh, we're not the only ones here. You know, look who's, I work at the university. Yeah. Look who's coming to, clean up my office at night, and look who's coming to serve the food in the cafeteria.
Right. And look who's not at the plays. Look at who's not at the concerts. Look who's not at the restaurants.
Yes.
We have a very small middle class African-American community that's middle class. And that's one of the issues as to why we're so separated, too. I mean, I just came from visiting friends up in Montclair. Mm-hmm. But Montclair is a very integrated community and has a lot of middle-class African-Americans. And that's part of the reason why it can be integrated, because people can live on the same block.
Right.
Because they have the same money. At least we don't prevent people from buying houses based on their color, just on their income. But often income and color are too closely related in our society. But let me get back to the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, because that's what I'm running for. So I don't want to do mandatory minimums. I don't want to prosecute small amounts of marijuana. I frankly have a libertarian instinct in me that says if somebody uses a drug and doesn't harm anybody else, that's their business, not mine.
Let me push back on that a little bit. And again, I'm just trying to act as advocate here. But making an economic argument about the failures of the war on crime is very compelling. But at the end of the day, it is someone's choice. It's not like they don't know that these things are illegal. So if someone knowingly commits an illegal act, and, whether or not marijuana, for example, gets decriminalized in Virginia, it's not yet.
Right.
So they are knowingly committing a crime.
Right.
Therefore, shouldn't they face the consequences for that?
So I have several responses. One is, there are a lot of crimes on the book in Virginia that are not enforced. Let me assure you of that. There is an ordinance in the city of Charlottesville that prohibits playing in the streets. I live on a dead-end street. Mm-hmm. You can imagine how many of the kids on the block play in the middle of the street with the basketball court. Mm-hmm. Nobody's enforcing that law. Those kids, their parents should know that it's illegal. But more importantly than that, it's illegal because somebody said it was illegal.
But that's how law works.
But when I look and considered how many times was a joint lit in Charlottesville in 2016, and the numbers start to run into the hundreds of thousands that a joint was lit on the campus, on Rugby Road, although a lot of people in Charlottesville smoke marijuana. Of those 100,000, 70 people, mostly African American, were charged with possession of marijuana. It's like being hit by lightning. It's gotten to that point. And this is the analogy also with prohibition. It got to the point in prohibition where so many people were drinking, even though it was illegal, that it collapsed of its own accord. And that's what's happening here as well. And when you start to see increasingly politicians recognizing that this is not a danger to society and we shouldn't be doing it, or at least there shouldn't be jail time, or there shouldn't be this, the question really is, what is the danger being posed by the person who we're prosecuting to us? It's not this sort of mythical question of, oh, you violated the law, therefore you must be punished, irrespective of what the law was and whether or not that law makes any of us safer. There are some things. Charlottesville has a law that allows the mayor to close down an immoral theatrical production. From what I can tell, the mayor's not exercising that power, but it's there. So he shouldn't be exercising
that power. Did you hear
that,
Mike Signer? Don't get any ideas.
Right, exactly. So there are lots of laws. There's the laws that we have in Virginia about the misuse of the flag. You cannot have the replica of a flag on your clothing. I just happened to pull in 2 weeks ago into my office, and somebody had a fabric of the American flag covering their rearview mirrors of their car.
Mm-hmm.
I took pictures of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a first-class misdemeanor, the same as possession of marijuana. But nobody's prosecuting it. Why not? It's a silly law, they say. Okay, I say the marijuana law has gotten, we've gotten to the point where it's a silly law and there's no need to enforce it. Now, I'm not the only person in the country who would do this. The first person I heard was the elected DA in Brooklyn. The elected DA in Houston, Texas is not doing this. There's an elected DA in Florida who's refusing to bring marijuana prosecutions. And everybody should look at the newly elected, not elected, who the guy who won the Democratic primary in Philadelphia, Larry Krasner. He's got a program that matches mine. You couldn't separate them with a zipper. And all of these same kinds of things, his concern over the years that he spent as a defense lawyer and a civil rights lawyer, looking at how bad the criminal justice system was, how we need to reduce the number of people going in, certainly nonviolent people, how we need to shift resources into the public health sector, how we need to get people out of jail. Nobody should be in jail awaiting trial just because they can't afford the money. You know, we put people in jail and hold them there if they're dangerous after we have a hearing. New Jersey just adopted this program. No cash bail. You get held if you are determined to be a danger after a hearing. Otherwise, something you are allowed out with some kind of conditions. Ankle bracelet, house arrest, whatever it is. Because people who are in jail before they go to trial are much more likely to be convicted and much more likely to get heavy sentences. And it's just unfair. You know, representing poor people, you know, often your client's your best investigator. You can't afford an investigator like the rich people can.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you see those things from having worked in the criminal justice system. And, you know, a lot of these things have built up for me over 50 years of working there. So those are the issues that I want to address. That's the passion that I bring to it. And, yes, I don't know all the answers. Nobody knows all the answers, I think, is the best answer. I like to quote Donald Trump. I never said I was perfect.
And he's proving it every day. But what about the children, Jeff?
Yes, what about the children? I see a lot of children who are missing their parents because they're in the criminal justice system. We have to do everything we can to keep drugs away from children because children's brains are developing and they can have an impact on that development. But you know what? We're not being very successful at the way we're doing it now. And although we have a drug task force, there's no less drug here. We go through heroin epidemics and then opioid epidemics and then meth epidemics. We just constantly go through those. And at some point, somebody's got to realize whatever we've done on the war on drugs has been an abject failure from the point of view of the people who wanted to stop drug usage. So if that's been an abject failure, we have to move in another direction. And to me, that direction is both getting it out of the criminal justice system and bolstering social services and opportunities for people. People will not commit crime if they have opportunities and hope that they can, you know, that they can make use of those opportunities. So we're not going to stop crime. We just have to be smart and focused and humane and fair, take care of victims, and not punish the innocent people who are the families of some of the people who commit crime.
Jeff, thank you so much for coming in. This has been an engaging discussion. We could go on for a while, but we don't have a while. My guest, Jeff Fogel, is a candidate for Charlottesville Commonwealth Attorney. I'm embarrassed I hadn't mentioned this yet. Your website is www.fogel4cca. That's Charlottesville Commonwealth Attorney. So Fogel4.us.
Us.
Yeah. Thank you. www.fogel4cca.us. You're also on Facebook and Twitter at Jeff Fogel for CCA, or just Google you or
yes.
whatever the kids do these days.
Whatever.
We can
June
find
13th,
you
have to mention.
Yes.
The primary is June 13th.
Primary is June 13th.
Tuesday.
And whatever you do, whoever you support, go out and vote. Let's not be that.
Absolutely.
Let's be the town that gets close to 100% participation. Wouldn't that be great? Jeff, thank you so much for coming in. This is Sean McCord subbing for Rick Moore on the Sunday morning wake-up call on WPVC here in the progressive heart of Charlottesville. Thank you for listening.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.